It's time for justice. Welcome to our special one-hour live broadcast of the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show about Virginia's 2010 legislative session. I'm your host, Marty Wagbright. This show is heard every Wednesday on 97.3 FM WRIR and is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free civil non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. In this week's one-hour special, we'll be talking with Virginia Poverty Law Center attorneys Jill Hankin, Jim Nagels, and Ty Jones about health, housing, and unemployment compensation issues confronting the General Assembly next year. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 70, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR, 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. We're back with our special one-hour live broadcast of the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show about Virginia's 2010 legislative session. And we'll be talking with Virginia Poverty Law Center attorney Jill Hankin about health law issues confronting the General Assembly next year. Welcome to the show, Jill.
Hi, Marty.
Jill, tell our listeners, first of all, the type of issues that you work on at the Virginia Poverty Law Center.
Well, I work on health issues that concern low-income people, and primarily I work on Medicaid and Children's Health Insurance Program policies. Those are state health programs for low-income people, and I work on policy issues and legislative matters as well.
Now, with the General Assembly session starting, I believe it's on January the 13th, the big issue obviously is the budget and the huge revenue shortfalls that are expected. And this undoubtedly will have some impact on the health issues that you follow. Could you describe that for us?
Well, it's true. This year, anyone who's interested in health issues will have to pay very, very close attention to Virginia's budget. As you said, the state is now experiencing a huge shortfall of revenues as a result of the current recession. Governor Kaine has already cut $7 billion out of Virginia's state budget, which annually is about $35 billion. So that's a substantial cut that's already been made to Virginia's budget. And we're now anticipating an additional revenue shortfall of up to $4 billion for the next biennium. There's not any place good to cut anymore. Many programs have already been reduced. Some health programs have actually been eliminated, like the state local hospitalization program that helped low-income people get coverage of their hospital bills. So we are eager to see and anxious to see what the governor has in mind this Friday when he releases his budget. And then, of course, Governor-elect McDonnell will have an opportunity to amend that budget. Unless there are some revenue enhancements included in the budget, I'm very, very concerned about the kind of cuts we'll see in Virginia's health programs, which are already very lean programs when compared to the rest of the country.
And we'll talk about the revenue enhancements shortly, but it was a good segue to a question that I wanted to ask. A lot of people think that Medicaid is a very expensive program, that it's very lavish, that its benefits are very generous, and that may or may not be the case in other states. It's certainly not the case in Virginia. Could you describe just how lean and how, I guess, parsimonious our program really is?
Well, the Medicaid program does provide comprehensive health insurance to people who are eligible. But our problem in Virginia is that our eligibility, the level of services provided, and the reimbursements paid to provider is very low when compared to other states. Overall, Virginia's per capita Medicaid expenditures are ranked 48th in the country, despite the fact that Virginia's per capita income is one of the highest in the country. In addition, our coverage for very poor parents is very limited for only parents who have income below 30% of the federal poverty line. For a family of four, that's in the neighborhood of $6,000, just $6,000 a year. So when compared to other states and even neighboring states, Virginia doesn't do very well for many of its low-income citizens. As a result, we have 1 million Virginians who are uninsured. The bulk of them are low-income people. About 60% are low-income Virginians with income below 200% of the poverty line, which is $44,000 for a family of four.
Now, I gather the situation is somewhat better for children and certainly somewhat better for the aged, blind, and disabled. Could you just describe for our listeners who is eligible and where eligibility, you know, could be better but in Virginia is not?
Well, we do moderately well for children and pregnant women, covering those individuals up to 200% of the poverty line, which, as I just said, is about $44,000 a year for a family of four. For the elderly and disabled, we cover them at a little less than the poverty line, but when people need long-term care, we do provide nursing home and other community-based services to just about anybody who needs it, whose income is less than what it costs to receive that care. But like I said, in other areas, like for low-income parents, we do very poorly. And for the elderly and disabled, not going up to the poverty line is also a problem.
So I gather that you would like to see the eligibility increased. That's not terribly likely to happen. Do we have any idea of what type of cuts are being proposed right now for the Medicaid program?
Well, as I said, it's really hard to imagine where there's any room to cut because the program's already been squeezed year after year to find any cost savings within that program. We already have pre-authorization requirements. We're heavily into managed care, which should be a cheaper way to provide Medicaid benefits. Our provider reimbursements have already been cut, particularly nursing homes and hospitals. There's really no easy place to look right now in the Medicaid program. So I don't know. I'm not going to venture a guess. We'll know a lot more on Friday when Governor Kaine's budget is released. But I would just urge everyone to pay close attention because any cuts to these programs are going to hurt some very vulnerable populations.
Now, you mentioned some possible revenue enhancements. I know in the last General Assembly, Governor Kaine proposed an increase in the cigarette tax and devoting that money exclusively to health care. That proposal didn't go anywhere. Are there similar ideas being floated about right now?
Well, again, you hear people talk about a lot of possibilities, and we'll know more on Friday, but certainly the cigarette tax is something that Governor Kaine may decide to propose once again. There are other possibilities in terms of what we call a dealer discount, where retail businesses are able to save some taxes based on the antiquated need to do accounting by paper, now that everything is done by computer, that payment to the state is no longer as necessary. And there are many other proposals. Even you could look at car tax relief. You could look at the income tax system in Virginia, which is very regressive. And I would suggest that individuals interested in this issue check out the website of the Commonwealth Institute for Fiscal Analysis. That group has done a lot of work identifying various revenue alternatives to help Virginia meet the needs of its citizens.
And I'd endorse that also. The director of the Commonwealth Institute, Michael Cassidy, was a guest on this show earlier this year. Well, now, you mentioned earlier, before we went on the air, that you're working with the new Healthcare for All Virginians Coalition. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. As I mentioned, Virginia has a lot of gaps in its services, health services to its citizens, and we have 1 million uninsured Virginians. About 167,000 of those uninsured Virginians are children. So many of us who work in the health field decided it was time to bring together a wide range of organizations to promote the kinds of positive changes that we need in Virginia. And after almost a year of work, we launched our new coalition called Healthcare for All Virginians. We launched it at the end of September. I'm pleased to report that there are 75 Virginia organizations involved in this coalition, ranging from consumer groups, religious groups, provider groups, insurance companies, all came together to promote three important issues. One is to cover all children. Many states have taken it upon themselves to make sure that no child in that state is uninsured. Like I said, we have 165,000 uninsured kids in Virginia, and there are ways with state and federal money to provide insurance to those children. In fact, Congress just enacted a reauthorization of children's health insurance last year, offering states more federal money to reach more children. So we believe Virginia ought to take steps to do just that.
And is that what we call in Virginia the FAMIS program?
Yes, exactly. The FAMIS program is the program that currently covers kids up to 200% of poverty. And we believe by raising it eligibility to 300% of poverty would reach most of those, if not all, of the uninsured children in Virginia.
And so I gather that there's some federal matching money that is available to Virginia to fund.
Absolutely. The FAMIS program is a very cost-effective program in that for every dollar Virginia pays on it, we receive $2 from the federal government. We think that's an excellent investment to make in the health of Virginia's children. The second priority of the Virginia Coalition, the Healthcare for All Virginians Coalition, is to protect and improve provider reimbursement. As I mentioned, providers have received many cuts already. Providers who are willing to serve Medicaid and FAMIS enrollees, we don't think they can afford any further cuts. And in fact, reimbursement is so low that we already have problems in certain areas with enrollees having adequate access to providers. Providers won't participate in these programs unless they're adequately reimbursed. So this is an important issue to our entire coalition, because even if eligibility is available, if there are no doctors to serve people, you haven't accomplished anything.
And just so our listeners understand, I gather that participation by providers in both of these programs, whether it's Medicaid or whether it's FAMIS, Family Access to Medical Insurance Security, is voluntary. It's optional on their part, isn't it?
Absolutely. It is optional, and many providers do participate and do wonderful work for this population, but there are financial concerns all around. The third priority of Healthcare for All Virginians Coalition is to address the problem of low-income working parents. As I noted earlier, our Medicaid eligibility is absurdly low, under 30% of the poverty line throughout Virginia. And in fact, in some localities, it's as low as 22% of the poverty line for parents to qualify for Medicaid. As a result, there are many very poor families where the parents don't have access to health insurance. We'd like to see that changed and raise eligibility for low-income parents at least to the national average, which is 65% of the poverty line, which is still quite low, but light years from where we are today.
And do you foresee that if these type of reforms are implemented, there might be a short-term increased cost now, but long-term cost savings down the line?
I think it's important to remember that when people don't have access to preventive care services and can't afford to pay for them themselves, very often medical conditions that could be treated get worse, and very often conditions that could be treated in doctor's offices end up being treated in hospital emergency rooms, which costs every one of us, because all of us pay for the unreimbursed services that are provided by hospitals and other providers. We pay for it in our own insurance premiums. And that's not to mention the fact that people literally die from being uninsured because they can't treat conditions, treat them too late, and die prematurely as a result.
Which is a good segue into the national debate that's going on right now. I mean, here we are. It's Wednesday, December the 16th. The headlines say that the Senate of the United States may be one vote short of national health insurance reform. And if that does pass, which is, as the president said, as he's cautiously optimistic, how's that going to affect Virginia? What type of issues will Virginia have to grapple with?
The impact of national health reform in Virginia will be huge and, in my opinion, will be hugely positive. First of all of us with private health insurance would receive the protections of the new rules that would prohibit denials of coverage for pre-existing conditions, prohibit caps on eligibility, and have reasonable premiums required and subsidies for those people who can't afford full premiums. It would also be huge in Virginia because part of national health reform would modify Medicaid eligibility and establish a new federal floor for Medicaid coverage. And as I have been talking about the leanness of our Medicaid program, that would change when the Medicaid provisions of national health reform are implemented, because the eligibility levels would rise for those low-income working adults. Not just parents, but all adults could qualify for Medicaid if their income was below, and depending on which number gets selected by Congress, either 133% of poverty or 150% of poverty, substantially higher than where we are now for adults. I've seen estimates that say that over 700,000 Virginians would be assisted by national health reform. A lot of that is through the public program enhancements and the subsidies for people with low income to help them buy private insurance.
Thanks for talking with us, Jill. We have been talking with Virginia Poverty Law Center attorney Jill Hankin about health law issues confronting the General Assembly next year. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to our special one-hour live broadcast of the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, about Virginia's 2010 legislative session. And now we'll be talking with Virginia Poverty Law Center attorney Jim Nagles about housing law issues confronting the General Assembly next year. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Good afternoon, Marty.
Jim, would you again tell our listeners briefly the type of issues that you work on with the Virginia Poverty Law Center?
As you sort of imply, the issues that I work on involve housing. Most of the time we are dealing with landlord-tenant issues, but lately we've had a lot to do with mortgage foreclosures, that being something that's very much a problem right now.
Now, in the area of evictions, one of the big problems obviously has to do with non-payment of rent. And Virginia law does allow a tenant to redeem their tenancy by paying essentially what they owe to the landlord by a certain date. Could you just describe for our listeners briefly what this involves, and then we'll talk about the proposal to make that system a little bit better?
Thank you, Marty. Basically, what happens in this process is that a landlord will give a tenant what's called a five-day pay or quit notice. The tenant that then has 5 days to either pay or quit, as it implies, or the landlord will take legal action against the tenant to evict him from the property. Subsequent to the landlord filing what's called a UD, or a warrant in unlawful detainer, the court will set up a hearing. The hearing will take place in a couple, 3 weeks. And as long as the tenant is able to redeem, that is to pay off the rent and costs by then, he is okay, as long as he doesn't do that more than once in a 12-month period.
But I gather that the money has to be received by that date, either by the landlord or by the landlord's attorney, or paid into the court. And if you're a day late, you're a dollar short. You're out of possession.
That's correct, Marty. He could be a day late and come up with the money, and then the landlord's not, in that circumstance, required to take the money. Once you get past the return date, that's the end of it.
And to gather, if the landlord, in fact, does take the money after that first court date, the landlord can accept it and give you a written notice saying, I'm taking the money, but I still want possession, I still want to evict you.
That's correct. What we're proposing in this year is a bill that would allow certain nonprofits, local government agencies, churches, et cetera, to come in and do something, I guess we could call it a pledge, for lack of a better term, saying that we will pay this rent arrearage and cost that the tenant owes by a certain date. And what we're proposing is that the church, et cetera, have up to 10 days after the return date to pay it. And the reason for that is that even if the tenant comes in and requests help from this nonprofit, local government, or church, sometimes they have a problem putting the money together before the return date. This way, they would have a little bit more time, 10 days, so that if they actually come up with the arrears, then the landlord, or it stops the process. If they don't, what would happen is that the process would continue as if the tenant never showed up at the return date, and the landlord would get possession of the property.
So what type of a response to this proposal have you heard from landlords or attorneys who represent landlords? You would think they would be favorably inclined, just because it is time-consuming to evict a tenant and to advertise for another tenant and do all the move out and move in inspections. You would think they'd be positively inclined toward this. Are they?
Yes and no, Marty. They believe that it's a good idea and concept, but they have some problems with how it would be carried out. One of the things we've heard from the landlords and their representatives is that they would like to make the acceptance of the proffered rent optional on the part of the court. What we'd like to do is make it mandatory to say that if this offer is made, if this tender is made by this land, local government, for example, that the court would have to accept it. What the landlords want to do is to have it as an option by the court, and we don't find that to be helpful.
Why would they want it to be optional? I mean, would they want particular factors looked at, or would it be just totally arbitrary?
I think it might be totally arbitrary. I think what they're trying to do, which is understandable, is to guard their own interest. What accepting the language that would make it discretionary with the court would do is basically gut the bill. So we're opposed to that particular change.
Now, an issue that you mentioned earlier, of course, is dealing with foreclosures. Now, obviously, there are a lot of foreclosures that are happening both to homeowners as well as to people who own rental property and their tenants occupying the premises. What happens under current law when a rental property is foreclosed upon?
Okay, there are a number of things involved. There is a new federal law that went into effect on May 20th, I believe, and that requires that if a property is bought, transferred to a new owner, then the tenant gets at least 90 days notice that he will have to leave. And in some circumstances, he gets a notice that he would have to leave at the end of his lease term.
Which could be 5-6.
Could be 5 or 6 months.
Okay.
We are proposing something that sort of works with that, or we're dealing with something that's been proposed on it. And that is a measure that would require that tenants get their security deposit plus interest from the new owner. Right now, the situation is that under the landlord-tenant law, for example, the tenant can be required by the existing landlord to provide as much as 2 months' rent as a security deposit. Under current law, it's also true that when the landlord sells the property to another owner, that owner is supposed to get the security deposit from the existing landlord. Those things don't address what happens once that is done, that is when the tenant is evicted or whatever because of the problem of foreclosure, what happens then? What this proposed measure would do would be to require that the new owner, the new landlord, provide that money or return that money to the tenant. And as it's written, that would happen even in the situation where it was doubtful that the new landlord had gotten the security deposit. We think that that particular proposal has the potential for being a good thing for the tenant, but there are some other things that some folks in our network and outside our network are concerned about.
So the current law requires the security deposit to go from the old owner to the new owner, but that doesn't always happen, and that certainly doesn't happen in a foreclosure situation, presumably because, I mean, the old owner, obviously they didn't have enough funds to pay the mortgage and prevent foreclosure. They probably don't have the security deposit anymore. Is that basically the problem that this is trying to address?
Well, that's a problem this is trying to address, but it really, the way it's written, it doesn't seem to matter whether the current landlord has the money or not. He is still required or would be required under state law to pay the security deposit. How that would work logistically, I don't know, but that's what the provisions provide for.
Okay. Another issue that has been discussed for years has to do with changing and really improving Virginia's fair housing law. Could you describe briefly what the current Virginia fair housing law is, what types of discrimination are prohibited, and how the law gets enforced?
Certainly, Marty. Right now, under the Virginia Fair Housing Law and under the federal fair housing law, there are a number of what are called suspect categories. Those suspect categories include race, color, national origin, elderliness, parenthood, etc. And what the law provides is that one cannot discriminate against those people in purchases, in rentals, and in finance based on those particular categories. We are concerned right now as to whether or not there should be provision in the Fair Housing Law that prohibits discrimination based on income. And the reason we're concerned about that is that it's become a habit among some landlords not to accept people who have housing choice vouchers. Now, ordinarily one might think, well, they have a good business reason for it, perhaps. Maybe they're not getting their money in time, et cetera.
Well, just to put this in context, you just describe briefly what exactly is a housing choice voucher.
A housing choice voucher is something that allows the federal government to pay part of a tenant's rent in order to make the housing unit the tenant wants to move into affordable for him. So, for example, the tenant is not required to pay any more than 30% of his income with certain adjustments, and the housing voucher will pay the rest.
And is this done by an actual contract between whoever is issuing this voucher to the landlord who is renting out the place?
Mm-hmm. Well, this is done through, well, first of all, the landlord is operating a program called under something called a housing assistance program, a HAP contract. Under the HAP contract, he's required to operate his program in accordance with the HUD guidelines on housing vouchers. At that point, what happens is the tenant goes out, finds a place to live. The tenant has the housing voucher, and there are several kinds or a couple of kinds. And I'll just deal with the tenant-based voucher. The tenant finds a place to live. He signs a lease with the landlord, and under that lease, it's provided that the program, the housing voucher program, will pay the part that it's supposed to pay, and the tenant will be responsible for up to 30% of his income.
But just as we talked about with Jill about Medicaid, medical providers don't have to accept Medicaid if they don't want to. I gather the same thing is true with landlord. They don't have to accept these housing choice vouchers if they don't want to.
Landlords don't have to take part in the program at all. They don't have to accept a housing choice voucher for a good reason. There may be a good reason for example, the tenant has been involved with the program and has not lived up to his part of it, has caused problems for the landlord in other areas, etc. There are any number of good reasons for the landlord maybe not to accept housing choice vouchers, but you can't not participate in the program because of reasons that are not allowed under Virginia or a state or a federal fair housing law. Sometimes landlords' refusals to accept housing choice vouchers, we suspect, are basically a proxy for discriminating against other people, particularly because of marital status or children, et cetera.
So what is the proposal that is being brought forth here to add something to the fair housing law to prohibit this type of discrimination?
Basically, it would be a proposal to prohibit discrimination based on the income source of the tenant, and that would include housing choice vouchers. It could also include certain payments under the GI Bill or other such sources of income.
And things like Social Security or SSI,
welfare benefits. That's
okay.
Right.
Now, one other issue that we talked about earlier before we went on the air was, and this is an unusual issue, but the effects of Chinese drywall. Can you tell us briefly why this is of concern now?
Yeah, that's something that's a little outside of what we normally are confronted with in the Poverty Law Center, but it's something that came up during a meeting of a work group from the Virginia Housing Commission. It seems that in a certain number of areas, particularly in places like Florida where there are humidity problems, for example, Chinese drywall has been used by people who are building new homes or adding or rehabilitating their homes or adding new parts to their homes. The problem with that particular product is that there is a quality about it that causes deterioration in plumbing, particularly with copper pipes, and deterioration of electrical connections and electrical wiring, causing shorts and, of course, leakages. The Virginia Department of Housing and Community Development has been trying to deal with that. They are the people who published the Uniform Statewide Building Code. During the meeting that I attended, there were a couple of people who talked about their particular situation. And while the problem was a really grave one, the difficulty is that the people in charge of the building code don't seem to have sufficient information about the actual science that's involved. They don't have information that tells them precisely what there is about this drywall that causes the problems it does. And it doesn't just cause deterioration. People who have asthma, children who have other respiratory conditions have been affected adversely by this as well. On inquiry, we didn't find any problems with this in Europe or other areas of the world. Not in China, where the drywall is produced. So we are at a loss as to what actually causes the problem and what to do about it.
Well, it sounds like it could possibly be a bonanza for trial lawyers at some point down in the future if there's some real problem here. This is apparently going to be studied more?
Yes, it will be studied more. And one of the problems is, who has liability for it? Whom do you go after in order to make these homeowners whole? You could look at the people who install it, but they didn't make it. You could look at the people who distribute it, but they didn't make it either. Or you could look at the nation of China, which has its own problems. It's very difficult to force the Chinese government to pay anything.
Indeed, I'm sure it would be. Well, thank you for talking with us, Jim. We've been talking with Virginia Poverty Law Center attorney Jim Nagles about housing law issues confronting the General Assembly next year. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to our special one-hour live broadcast of the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, about Virginia's 2010 legislative session. And now we'll be talking with Virginia Poverty Law Center attorney Ty Jones about unemployment compensation issues confronting the General Assembly next year. Welcome to the show, Ty.
Hi, Marty.
And would you tell our listeners, again, the type of issues that you work on with the Virginia Poverty Law Center?
Well, my title is Public Benefit Staff Attorney. So that includes food stamps, or SNAP, as it's now called, TANF, which is the cash assistance program in Virginia, and unemployment compensation.
And I'm sure unemployment compensation must be a huge part of your work just because of the huge unemployment problem in the country right now. I've heard that the Virginia Employment Commission is handling, receiving 10,000 new claims a week, handling somewhere between 600 to 900 appeals a week, and all those figures are double what they were a year ago at this time. And I understand that just yesterday you were at a special stakeholders meeting at the Virginia Employment Commission discussing the problems that this onrush of claims has caused. Could you tell our listeners about those discussions?
That's correct, Marty. Yesterday, the Virginia Employment Commission had their stakeholders meeting, and it was a pretty sad and depressing meeting. We talked about everything from the unemployment rate to the trust fund balance. Virginia's unemployment rate in June was 7.3%, which was the highest it's been since 1983. And with the high unemployment rate, the Virginia Employment Commission is paying out more benefits. They have a call center, they have an internet, and you can come into an office. But with the economic downturn, there's also been reductions in staff at the VEC. So at the same time that there's an increase in the need, there's less staff. So we discuss each of those issues. One issue that we discussed that I mentioned was the trust fund, which the trust fund is the money that the VEC uses to pay out benefits to individuals who receive unemployment benefits. This money is received from employers due to their size, how many unemployment claims, is a various amount of factors that are determined. But that money goes into the trust fund, and then the VEC takes this money out of the trust fund to pay out benefits.
And I gather that that trust fund is right now officially insolvent.
So what we learned is as of October, the trust fund balance was zero. What happens when it gets to zero, the VEC borrows money from the federal government. And currently, as of yesterday, the VEC has borrowed $76 million from the federal government. They plan to, all the way till, I think, 2011, borrow up to $1.3 billion. One issue that was brought up was that during the 2009 General Assembly session, as a part of President Obama's stimulus bill, he had an option, he gave an option to all states to modernize their unemployment programs in order to receive money. Virginia was in line to receive $125 million if we modernize our program.
And I gather we had a list of issues that we could choose, two out of the four issues to implement, and I gather we'd get $125 million if we chose two of those issues.
That's correct. So we chose coverage for part-time workers, which currently in Virginia, if you're a part-time worker, you're not eligible to receive unemployment. And also we chose to have individuals who are in training programs that are going from low-demand jobs into more higher-demand jobs that they can continue to receive unemployment while in training. Those were our two issues. Unfortunately, the General Assembly rejected Governor Kaine's amendment to a bill that would allow Virginia to draw down this extra $125 million during this tough economic times. And what we found out at the VEC stakeholders meeting was that if we had taken that $125 million, that currently Virginia would not be borrowing from the federal government. And this is, I mean, it's a problem on numerous levels, but one main problem with the borrowing is that any interest that is accrued from the loans that we receive from the federal government have to be paid from our state general funds. And with our budget, as Jill mentioned earlier, with a $1 billion deficit, and it's only going to get bigger, we would hate to have to take any of the money from the state general funds to pay back these loans. So had we taken the $125 million, we would have had less loans to pay back.
So has the opportunity for Virginia to draw down that $125 million of stimulus money, is that just gone now?
Fortunately, the opportunity is still there. We heard interest during the stakeholders meeting that legislators might be trying to bring the bill back up. And this is something that we at the Virginia Poverty Law Center would be totally behind. We would like to go ahead and still take this $125 million. What we found out during the meeting is, although now, yes, we're already in borrowing mode, taking the $125 million will reduce the amount of interest. And the VEC has exact figures of how much less in interest we would have to pay if we take this $125 million.
So is the idea to, in the 2010 General Assembly, to try to get those same two modernizations through, that is, having benefits for part-time workers and also benefits for people who are in training for high-demand jobs?
They are, for numerous reasons. Number one, we think that the UI, receiving benefits while in training, is important both to claimant and to the employer. The employer is going to be able to have an employee come back who is trained, who is more qualified for their job, and also the individual has more skills that they can use, whether at that employment or at another. So we still believe that UI training is still very important. Coverage for part-time workers is the same thing. With our tough economy, a lot of people are only able to get part-time work. Sometimes they hold two part-time jobs just in order to pay their bills. And we also found out that a lot of seniors now with this tough economy are going back into the workforce because Social Security or maybe their retirement benefits aren't enough to pay their bills. So we think that part-time coverage and UI and training is still important. The other two issues, dependent care coverage, although that's important and so is the domestic reasons, we just think that the biggest and the most potent for Virginians would be the UI while in training and also the part-time coverage.
Now you mentioned leaving work for personal or domestic reasons. I recently had a case, and I understand that this is something that's been unfunded, but current law says that if you leave work to accompany a spouse, you don't get benefits unless you're leaving work to accompany a spouse who's in the military and has been transferred away. And I had a client who was married to somebody at Fort Lee, was transferred to North Carolina, where she accompanied him, and denied benefits. And I gather the law is written so that if that provision is funded, she would get benefits, but it's not currently funded, so she didn't.
That's correct. And that's that bill, which was Senator Locke's bill, the trailing spouse for military spouses, that's the bill that was used as the vehicle to try to get through this UI modernization. And what happened is during one particular committee session, this clause was put on it that said we would allow spouses of military who leave their employment to follow their spouse to receive unemployment if the federal government sends us money specifically for this purpose. Well, the only reason that the government would do that is if we decide to accept that as a new provision in our law that is required under the Modernization Act. And this was not done. So basically, it's the same. It's a bill with no bite. And so that's one of our choices is, do we want to go ahead and try to push through Senator Locke's bill again with this provision to try to, you know, give it a little more bite, especially with we have two wars going on. It seems really hard, and it was very hard for me to understand how our Virginia General Assembly could turn their back on so many, you know, people who risk their lives for us every day.
Indeed, it was quite hard for me to explain to this lady in North Carolina, well, yeah, you had no choice. Your husband had no choice. He was transferred. He's defending our country, but you get denied unemployment compensation. So I guess the idea is to sort of sweeten the pot and say that, you know, if we take this, if we make the two modernization changes that get the $125 million, we would also get additional federal money on top of that to fund the trailing spouses of military people?
Well, actually, it wouldn't be an addition because it's actually only up to $125 million that we would get from those two provisions. But this way, not only we're kind of getting more for our efforts. We're not only getting the UI training and the part-time, but we're also getting coverage for trailing spouses of military personnel.
Okay. So proposals that also resurface from time to time have to do with benefits for seasonal workers. Could you tell us what the existing law is for people who only work part of the year? For example, people who work for H&R Block and places like that.
Well, current law, the only individuals who are not eligible for unemployment due to seasonal work are individuals who may be teachers. They consider teachers to say they're not eligible just because during the summer you're not employed, you would not be able to receive unemployment. And they have certain athletes of some of our minor league sports teams, they're not able to receive unemployment during the off season. So that's the only people currently who would be prohibited from filing for unemployment during the off season. And what the bills that we've seen last year and we will probably see again, what they're attempting to propose is to allow employers to classify certain employees as seasonal. And there's certain restrictions. There were different bills. Some bills were very broad, where almost any employer would be able to come in and just classify anything as a season to say, hey, for us, we work very hard during the General Assembly. Our boss can say, hey, from January to March, you all are seasonal. And after that, you know, so you wouldn't be eligible to receive unemployment. Then there was another bill that specifically wanted to carve out an exception for anyone, for tax preparers, people who work for H&R Block or Liberty Tax. And both of the bills were killed during the General Assembly session. And my issue and the Poverty Law Center's issue with these bills is in 1978, prior to 1978, Virginia had seasonality provisions. We had certain exceptions for certain employees. And at that time, in 1978, they said this is bad for policy reasons. It's bad public policy. You can have two similarly situated employees that work for different employers who one employer decided to ask for the seasonal exception and one didn't. And then both of them lose their job and one would be eligible and one would not. So for those reasons and numerous other policy reasons, they decided to overturn the seasonality provisions. In 2009, there's nothing different. If anything, we definitely do not want to go back to law that was enacted prior to 1978. And also, I think that it would give employers a lot more options to just restrict more individuals from receiving unemployment. And at this time, I don't see why anyone would want to make it harder for people who do have a significant tie to the workforce from being able to receive unemployment benefits.
So are there going to be any efforts to try to expand eligibility for unemployment compensation? And I know that Virginia has one of the lowest participation rates of any state in the country. Can you first of all tell us, why that seems to be the case?
We have the lowest just because of our requirements. We have some of the strictest eligibility requirements out of any most of the other states. For example, we have a minimum earnings requirement, which is the minimum amount of earnings you must have received in your base period to qualify for unemployment benefits.
Now tell us, first of all, what is exactly a base period?
In base period, what the VEC does is they look back over your last year of employment, and it's broken down into four calendar quarters, and you have to have earned a certain amount of money in your two highest quarters. Currently, the amount is $2,700. During the 2008 General Assembly session, there was a bill that was passed that wanted to raise it to $3,000. The bill was passed, but it was a provision that delayed its enactment until July of 2009. At that time in 2008, there were 850 individuals who were currently receiving unemployment benefits who would no longer be eligible with the new rules. In the 2009 session, they decided to delay it once more. And during that time, it was even more people. There were 1,000 people who would have been ineligible under the new terms. So that's one reason. In a comparison to other states, our minimum earnings requirement is pretty high.
So what is the implementation date now for that new requirement for higher base period wages?
It is currently for January of 2010, but during our VEC stakeholders meeting, we learned that they're going to ask for another delay. So now we're looking at January of 2011. So currently, if you have $2,700 as far as your minimum earnings, you are still eligible to receive unemployment benefits.
I know one of the big issues that people have right now is just accessing the Virginia Employment Commission system. In the Richmond area, 5 years ago, there were three offices. There was one by Willow Lawn, there was one in South Richmond, there was one in East Richmond. All three are gone. The closest office really is out in Mechanicsville, 2 miles from the end of a bus line. How do you recommend that people actually navigate their way through this system?
Yeah, that's one of our big issues and our big concerns. And we're always in discussions with the Virginia Employment Commission asking about access. There's a call center, but we have found that when we're with clients and we try to call the number, you can be on the number online for 30 to 45 minutes. And that could just be to file your claim or to file your weekly job search. There's also the VEC has a website. Then they have an internet-based application, and you can file your weekly job claims online. That's really what the Virginia Employment Commission is pushing. They're pushing everyone to get online, to get on the computer, and access it. The best suggestion that we have is if you can go to a local office to have face-to-face, in-person contact, that's honestly the best way. If you cannot, then internet is the second best option.
And that internet system, is that available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week?
It is. And if for individuals who do not have internet access, we definitely suggest the public library or, something like that in order to get on the internet, because some people just aren't going to be able to make it to the local offices. And we have some places in Virginia where there are no local offices, so they totally have to resort to internet or telephone.
And you mentioned something about not only filing the claim, but also filing weekly claims. Can you just lead our listeners through that very briefly?
Yes. In order to receive unemployment, you have to, one, be eligible, and that's, as I mentioned, the minimum earnings requirements, and you haven't lost your job through any fault of your own. But in order to continue and stay receiving unemployment, you have to file a weekly job search, which requires you to make at least 2 job contacts per week. And that's what you do online. You give information on where you made the contact, the person whom you contacted, and the telephone number.
And that has to be filed, every week, basically reporting what you did the prior week?
Yes, that is correct. So, and it's really important, when we try to emphasize to everyone to continue to do their job searches, because any week where you don't, it's basically you're disqualified for that week, so you will not receive benefits for that week.
So it's basically file or lose eligibility for that week.
That is correct.
Well, thanks for being with us, Ty. We've been talking with Virginia Poverty Law Center attorney Ty Jones about unemployment compensation issues confronting the General Assembly next year. This is the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio show ever broadcast is now available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wagbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society.